Well, thank you, Ian, and Catherine, and all the other organizers for Foodscapes. It's been a wonderful day. So let's get tubercular and explore the relationship between food and farm. This paper is taken out of my doctoral dissertation that I'm currently wrapping up. It explores the eradication of bovine tuberculosis in Canada and the United States from the 1890s to about the early 1960s. My study focuses on the formation and operation of various bovine tuberculosis programs over the roughly 70-ish years it took to eradicate the disease, and explores how this disease was essentially legislated out of existence, rather than through a sudden, dramatic scientific innovation. And I do this through exploring how different programs unfolded over time in Ontario and New York State specifically. And I chose these places for a couple of reasons. One, the few scholars who have looked at the history of bovine tuberculosis tend to focus more on the major cattle states and areas of the Midwest and the West, which is kind of in keeping with the kind of overall narrative of livestock agriculture. I chose the East mainly because of its large human and livestock populations that still exist there, and therefore I think it's an important place epidemiologically to look at. Secondly, Canada and the United States had really very different approaches initially to combating this disease, and over time you see kind of a coming together of thought and practice, and ultimately the programs that were ultimately successful in eradicating bovine tuberculosis look very similar, and I wanted to see whether there was any points of intersection and collaboration that occurred, and I've found out that indeed there was. Today, I will be speaking about a particular program that took place in Canada beginning in 1914 that again looks at this relationship between disease, food, and farm. It was a program that offered an agricultural solution to the public health program of bovine tuberculosis, and it was called the Municipal Tuberculosis Order. First, briefly, though, bovine tuberculosis, or Mycobacterium bovis, is a strain of the larger Mycobacterium tuberculosis complex, and that's what it looks like. There are several different strains of tuberculosis, as you can see, some of which affect humans, most of which affect humans, but most often it's very rare that people would catch them. The strain that's most often associated with humans is Mycobacterium tuberculosis. That's the sort of pulmonary form that we see in humans with, you know, coughing up sputum, sending people to a sanatorium, that sort of thing. Bovine tuberculosis is one of the zoonotic strains of tuberculosis that can infect various animal species as well as humans. The tuberculosis in general, the bacilli responsible for it, was discovered by Robert Koch in 1882. And in 1890, he first developed what he thought initially was a cure for bovine tuberculosis. It wound up not being a cure and caused quite a bit of controversy, but it turned out to be a very useful diagnostic agent. And that's how tubercular cattle were and still are identified. In cattle, bovine tuberculosis is highly contagious. It is most often passed from one cow to another through inhalation. Tuberculosis has the ability quite effectively to hang in the air for quite a long time, and a dairy barn is quite an effective way for it to do that. In terms of how it affects cattle, generally an animal will develop lesions internally in its lungs. The lesions also sometimes go to the digestive tract. The udders are really quite a common place for them as well. Really, tubercular lesions can develop anywhere in a cow's body. They can go into the muscle tissue. They can even develop lesions on their eyes. This cow right here has, it's hard to see, this is a very grainy picture from the 1910s, but this cow has very, very swollen udders. And this was one of the outward clinical symptoms that indicated that it was probably suffering from the disease. In terms of clinical symptoms, this case, swollen udders or lesions on the eyes or something very traumatic, that was really quite rare. Often a cow riddled with tuberculosis showed absolutely no outward signs that it was ill. And I've read report after report in the farm press, in reports from the Health of Animals branch in Canada, from farmers and veterinarians who were floored to find out that a large percentage, or even the whole herd, had tuberculosis, because by all outward appearances, they looked fine. They weren't eating less. They weren't milking less. They looked perfectly healthy. And this had very significant implications for the eradication of this disease. When we think of sort of recent episodes of zoonotic diseases, if you think of SARS or bird flu or one of the other ones that have been in the news lately, these diseases often present themselves as very sudden and dramatic outbreaks. And bovine TB was not like that at all, which partially makes it such an interesting disease to study. It spread very, very slowly and quietly, without anybody noticing. And when the problem was fully realized, not only in Canada, the United States, in Europe, when the problem was realized, it was more a slow realization that there was a massive endemic disease in cattle than there was a dramatic epidemic of it. So the most common way for humans to contract bovine TB was, and really still is, to ingest it. Meat and especially milk were the most common vessels. Milk was a more common vessel than meat, mainly because it was consumed in its raw form more frequently. In terms of what it does to the human body, it often affects the organs of the digestive system as well as the lymphatic system, and produced a lot of lesions on the skin. And lesions would often erupt on the lymph nodes around the neck. And so that's an example of it, just right about here. I could have shown you way nastier pictures. It's kind of become common for me to gross people out when I give a talk on this, but this is one of the more tame pictures. So it is in tubercular milk that the most dramatic public health effects of bovine tuberculosis were demonstrated, and it's on dairy farms especially that a relationship between public health, veterinary medicine, and the state is very evident. And this relationship became more visible in the early 20th century with calls for the greater sanitation and safety of milk, part of this pure food movement that we see in this period. Calls for TB-free milk and milk regulations generally in this period are often framed in their relationship to children. Children, of course, were the greatest consumers of fresh milk and thus were particularly susceptible to contracting bovine TB. The statistics are a little fuzzy, but it's thought that maybe roughly 5 to 10% of cases of tuberculosis in children were caused by bovine TB. Children who had contracted tuberculosis from milk were often used as examples by public health advocates for illustrating the need to eradicate the disease. And of course, this is a picture of a child and was used by, I think this is from the Canadian Tuberculosis Association, whatever it was called in that period. It's changed names a number of times, but were these acute, very dramatic cases common? The evidence is unclear, but quite likely no. As was the case with a lot of diseases, though, especially ones that affected children, the most dramatic cases were often the ones used to scare the hell out of people and advocate for reform. Beginning in the mid-1890s, the Canadian government began to actively address the problem of bovine tuberculosis in its national herd. And its beginnings were fairly modest. The program in Canada begins in 1895 with a policy known as the Tuberculosis Act. Tuberculin was provided free of charge. No compensation was offered to owners whose animals were found to be diseased, and the cattle who were infected had to be slaughtered immediately. Plus, the farmer had to pay room and board for the livestock inspector that was coming out to examine their herd. This was followed in 1903 by an order which was like the 1895 tuberculosis plan, but allowed farmers the option of keeping their animals if they were found to be diseased, with the requirement that they mark the animal with a T in its ear. This is the device used to make that. We have that in the collection across the road. It's about yay big and weighs about 5 pounds. And it's one of my favorite pieces in the collection, not just because it's related to my work, but also it still has fur stuck to it, which I find really neat. I know that's kind of gross, but anyways. But marking animals allowed owners to keep them. Bear in mind that a lot of early testing on tuberculosis was done on the most valuable animals. dairy animals and especially breeding animals. These were very valuable animals, and the ability to keep them was really important to a lot of livestock owners. So this allowed them to keep their animals, but not to sell them. And they were required to keep them obviously separate from their herds so that further infection wouldn't occur. In 1905, another policy was introduced by the Canadian government called the Supervised Herd Plan. This was mainly directed towards export animals, and again, no compensation was offered. But once declared a supervised herd, it made the export of animals to the United States especially a lot more easy. These were very modest beginnings, and again, very focused on animals for export and breeding animals. The federal government of Canada, really until the 1910s, was not in a position to create a national testing program, and they cited expenses and losses. The thought at that time was perhaps 30% of Canada's national herd was affected with this disease, and to wipe them all out completely in one fell swoop would be economically devastating to an industry which was growing quite considerably in this period. Ultimately, bovine tuberculosis in cattle was eradicated through a combination of programs. It wasn't one particular program. It was a combination of three: supervised herd plan from 1905, as well as the accredited herd plan of 1919, which was quite similar to the supervised herd plan of 1905, although it provided compensation for losses, as well as the restricted areas plan that happens in 1922, which defined whole geographical areas of herds that were then tested. So there's quite a combination of programs that Canada moves forward with. And that's part of the reason I believe, and I argue in my thesis, why it took so long to eradicate the disease, because there was this legacy of all of these different programs rather than one cohesive program. However, between the 1905 supervised herd plan and the accredited herd plan in 1919 was another program called the Municipal Tuberculosis Order. Introduced in 1914, its aim was to support municipalities who wanted to pass bylaws compelling tuberculin testing for dairy herds who supplied their milk. The federal government provided this aid mainly through financial support for compensating owners for their tubercular cattle, as well as providing manpower for the actual tuberculosis testing. Despite its promise as a program, the Municipal Tuberculosis Order lasted less than 10 years. And when I laid out all of the eradication programs that Canada had as a whole, from the first one in 1895 to the last one they created in 1922, I questioned whether or not it was worth examining the Municipal Tuberculosis Order at all. It was such a short-lived program, and when it was in operation, it didn't experience the kind of growth that other programs did. So was it really worth examining? I think it was. I think it is, and I think so mainly because the significance of the Municipal Tuberculosis Order lies more, I think, in the story it connects to than what it actually accomplished as a program. I see the Municipal Tuberculosis Order as part of the larger process of ensuring safe milk in the early 20th century that saw attention focused both on the product, milk, and its source, which was livestock. A process that highlighted a growing relationship between public health and veterinary medicine and reflected really the relationship between farm and food. If you look at cities and towns throughout the early 20th century, aside from some milk that was produced within cities, milk came from surrounding areas, often hundreds of kilometers away, and was processed and distributed by several dairies and creameries. With developments in transportation, refrigerated rail cars, perishable products like milk began to travel into city centers from much further away and was processed and distributed, again, by several dairies and creameries. People were, consumers, therefore, were more directly influenced by the conditions on dairy farms and the health of dairy animals hundreds of kilometers away from them. I think it's useful to think of farms as centers of production and creameries and dairies as centers of processing and distribution in this period. They're all part of kind of an industrializing system in this period, and we see the standards that begin to govern the processing and distribution of milk penetrate these centers of production as well. The most efficient solution to protect public health from bovine TB in milk was obviously to pasteurize it. And there's a large and growing body of scholarship on the history of milk reform, the debate over pasteurization and raw milk. I don't want to really delve into that debate. It's a rather prickly one for a lot of people even today. But rather to illuminate how authorities of that time hoped to achieve a safe version of raw milk. Briefly, pasteurization was developed in the late 19th century by Louis Pasteur, whereby milk was heated to certain temperatures to kill any harmful bacteria. It was effective for killing tuberculosis as well as a host of other diseases that were in milk, like salmonella, typhoid fever was quite common in milk. Milk in general in some places in Canada was pretty disgusting in the early 20th century. This process, though, was not overwhelmingly embraced when it was first introduced in the late 19th century, and its adoption over the decades since was gradual and uneven. And it wouldn't be until almost the mid-20th century that pasteurization would be a national practice in either Canada or the United States. But many communities did start to practice it on their own. Again, it was kind of a gradual and uneven process. Toronto was the first city to mandate pasteurized milk in 1914, Windsor in 1926, Hamilton in 1928, and Ontario mandated pasteurization under Premier Mitchell Hepburn in 1938. By the time pasteurization was mandated by the province of Ontario in 1938, well over 50 communities were practicing it, and they were largely urban. In rural communities, though, pasteurization wasn't as common. Milk was consumed fairly fast from its source, and therefore, you know, perhaps less bacteria would get into it, although the threat of tuberculosis was still very real. So if milk wasn't pasteurized, what was done to it? For a lot of communities, certified or safe milk was a more viable option. Certified milk essentially meant supervised milk, that all levels of milk production were supervised as sanitary, meaning the cows were healthy, free of disease, like tuberculosis, and living in sanitary conditions, and that the milk was stored in clean cans, it wasn't adulterated in any way, and local governments and boards of health had the power to impose bylaws for this and carry them out. However, a number of municipalities did not have any kind of standards for their milk at all. Pasteurized or certified, or they had some and it was unevenly applied. Logistically, it can be quite difficult and expensive to supervise milk in this way. To supervise farms, to ensure some level of quality, to make sure it wasn't being adulterated. When milk was distributed occasionally, particularly if it was being distributed by tank trucks, things, it wasn't uncommon for milk to be watered down and chalk added to it to make it look milky. And so these sorts of things were a major concern for public health advocates. Their concern, of course, was not just for the milk, but also where it came from. These advocacy groups began to press the federal government to address bovine tuberculosis in this health forum more directly. They were aware of the bovine tuberculosis work that was already going on. And individuals involved in advocacy programs felt domestic attention was warranted as well. And there were several of these groups and individuals involved in advocacy. Adelaide Hudlis, we heard about this morning, was a major advocate of pasteurization and milk reform, but so too were the Canadian Tuberculosis Association, for example, but so were the medical milk commissions that became fairly common in this period. So the Canadian Medical Milk Commission began in 1908, with Ontario forming its own in 1909. Appointed by the provincial government and made up primarily of physicians, they were tasked with investigating the safety and quality of milk in various communities throughout the province. They were asked to certify milk as safe and explore and work with local boards of health. Again, many boards of health were already doing this work. Sometimes the medical milk commissions were brought in to or appointed within communities to sort of augment what was already happening. Once certified, dairies and creameries often advertised the fact that they had certified or safe milk. And I actually brought a prop. This is Silverwood's safe milk. Silverwood's was a dairy in London. And often if you go to an antique store or something and you see milk bottles, more often than not, you'll see a bottle that says safe milk or certified milk or says something about the purity and safety of it. The Ontario Milk Commission began working to identify inadequacies and challenges faced by municipalities in managing the quality and safety of their milk supplies and produced an interesting report in 1910, recommending how the province might move forward to ensure the safety of certified milk. The report noted that only a few municipalities by that time had adopted a certified milk plan, and they proposed the creation of a scorecard system to evaluate the cleanliness and storage conditions for farms. And in addition, they proposed a consistent set of inspection and cleanliness standards for those who sold milk. One of the most notable features, and this is important for the Municipal Tuberculosis Order, was their focus on dairy cattle. The tuberculous cow must go was a notable feature of their report. And the commission argued that the disease in cattle needed to be more systematically addressed than it had been until that time. The creation of standards for cleanliness was fine, but did not, in their minds, fully address the issue. The reliance on standards of cleanliness created almost a false sense of security that bovine tuberculosis could never reach consumers. So the commission, along with groups like the Canadian Tuberculosis Association, lobbied the federal government to devote resources to bovine tuberculosis eradication in dairy cattle, as they had already been doing so for other animals. Despite declaring themselves not in a position to oversee a national testing program at that time, the Department of Agriculture acquiesced and created the Municipal Tuberculosis Order as a more focused program to support municipalities tackle the problem of bovine TB from the side of production. Of the creation of the Municipal Tuberculosis Order in 1914, the Veterinary Director General, so the head veterinarian of the Canadian government, who at that time was Frederick Torrance, said, quote, "After much careful consideration of the whole subject, it was decided to attack the disease at the point where it is most dangerous to the human race. An attempt would be made to prevent the sale of tuberculous milk in cities and towns and to ensure that the milk supply should be derived solely from cows that had passed the tuberculin test. In order to secure the cooperation and goodwill of the citizens to this work, it was decided to apply it only to such cities and towns as made a request for it and were already licensing dairies and keeping them to a certain standard of cleanliness and sanitation. Provision was made for dealing with reactors in a liberal way so as to minimize the loss to the owner as much as possible." So again, the goal of the Municipal Tuberculosis Order was not necessarily to create something new, but to augment something that was already being addressed and perhaps serve as an incentive for other communities to look at their milk supplies. The Municipal Tuberculosis Order was offered to municipalities of no less than 5,000 residents initially. The program came with several conditions for municipalities to comply with in order to participate, including, for example, a licensing and inspection of dairies if municipalities were not already doing so, as well as the installation of an inspector to ensure that dairy cattle under supervision were clean, well-fed, and cared for, and that the stables were clean and well-ventilated. Once accepted into the program, the Office of the Veterinary Director General would send a veterinary inspector to begin the work of administering tuberculin tests. Cattle showing obvious clinical signs of the disease were sent immediately to abattoirs for slaughter, with the inspector present to ensure its proper disposal. Reactors identified with the tuberculin test could either be immediately slaughtered or be kept in a herd so long as any milk they produced was pasteurized. This wasn't done a whole lot. Keeping two separate herds was quite cumbersome for dairy owners, so quite often they would just have the cow slaughtered, or they would only keep it to breed it and just discard any milk that it produced. After two consecutive successful tests failing to identify tuberculosis in a herd, the inspector issued a certificate deeming the herd clean or certified. Owners were compensated for the destruction of their tubercular cattle, and this was the first time. This was the first time that it was offered. Owners with open cases of tuberculosis or very obvious clinical symptoms were compensated half their appraised value, as determined by the veterinary inspector. And grade cattle were compensated one-third of their appraised value. The first municipality to participate in this program was Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, followed by Regina in 1916. That only two municipalities had requested assistance under this program was quite frustrating for the Health of Animals branch. In an effort to attract more municipalities to participate in the program, the program was amended in 1916, and to include all municipalities, regardless of population, in perhaps in a way to attract smaller municipalities. The amendments bore fruit as two additional municipalities, North Battleford, Saskatchewan, and Ottawa, Ontario, signed on shortly after these amendments were made. The Municipal Tuberculosis Order expanded slowly over the next few years, but it turned out to be a cumbersome program to administer efficiently. A major issue for the program was the frequent movement of dairy animals. We tend to think of livestock, especially dairy cattle, as living very stationary lives. In fact, in many cases, they don't. Writing in 1917, for example, Torrance noted that it was common practice to sell cows that had finished their lactation period and replace them with cows that were just beginning one. These cows, known as springers, were, quote, made the work of testing almost a continuous performance. Okay. Despite the involvement of a number of communities, the level of participation fell far short of the Department of Agriculture's expectations. Torrance, writing in 1917, could not understand why more municipalities were not taking advantage of a program that provided compensation to cattle owners. Most notably, he argued the usefulness of the program given the results demonstrated from the participating municipalities. He said, quote, in one dairy, our inspectors found 10 cows, all of which reacted to the tuberculin test. When these were slaughtered, all were found diseased, some extensively. Among them were cows whose milk was loaded with tubercular bacilli. The dairy was distributing raw milk to the city. How many children were exposed to disease in this way is unknown, or how many contracted the disease, but there is no reason to expect that all escaped. In Torrance's opinion, municipalities who relied solely on pasteurization or nothing at all were taking serious unnecessary risks with their citizens' health. Quote, the burden of carelessness does not fall upon those who deserve it, but upon the poor defenseless children, many of whom are doomed to the early graves or lives of crippled misery from tubercular infection. Ultimately, the Municipal Tuberculosis Order was canceled in 1923. Support for communities still under the program continued until they were incorporated into one of the later programs, most often the Restricted Area Plan. When the program was discontinued, there were 30 communities still actively involved, with the Ontario communities of Brantford, Ottawa, Collingwood, Smiths Falls, Brockville, and the one you're currently sitting in, Guelph, among them. So to conclude, what can be said of this program that was canceled? Although it didn't last and become part of the collective programs that ultimately eradicated bovine TB in Canada, I think it highlights a few interesting things about the period, about the disease, and about the role of veterinary medicine in food safety, a role that has become incredibly common now. Firstly, I think the Municipal Tuberculosis Order highlights an important intersection between public health, between the public health threat of bovine TB and the disease in livestock. The disease in cattle and the disease in animals were ultimately treated separately, pasteurization and these testing programs I highlighted. But especially for the cattle testing programs that were to come, even though the concerns overwhelmingly were for the health of the livestock industry, there is always this veneer of public health that coats the discourse about why it was so critical to eradicate this disease. I think the Municipal Tuberculosis Order represents a time when the two really came together at a time of regulatory and scientific uncertainty and attempted some kind of solution. And the solution they attempted was really a bureaucratic one, interestingly. And this is the second aspect of the Municipal Tuberculosis Order that I really think made it significant. At a time when the scientific innovations designed to treat milk for bovine TB were not necessarily accepted and unevenly applied, a bureaucratic innovation was applied. And reflects how bovine TB was treated generally as a whole, that you could realistically arrest and eliminate this disease through a slow and sustained effort of the application of testing rather than a dramatic intervention of science. Thank you.